Hello and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. What's wrong with the national pastime? Seems like everyone has an opinion, but some strike me as being more informed than others. That's the feeling I came away with after reading Lincoln Mitchell's new book, Will Big League Baseball Survive? Globalization, the End of Television, Youth Sports, and the Future of Major League Baseball. I can always tell how much a book has intrigued me by the number of pages I dog-ear and the notes I write in the margins, which in this case was extreme. Mitchell is a writer, pundit, and specialist in political development based in New York City and San Francisco. Among many other things, he was the national political correspondent for the New York Observer, a member of the faculty of Columbia University's School of International Affairs from 2006 to 2013, and worked for many years as a political consultant in New York City, advising and managing domestic political campaigns. He also hosts Painting the Corners, the Baseball and International Affairs podcast, which brings together people from the worlds of baseball and foreign policy to discuss the two topics in an informal conversational setting. Now, I usually like to put up these interviews ahead of the author's appearance at the Bergino Baseball Clubhouse in Manhattan, but I blew it this time, and my apologies to all the parties involved. So here's our conversation with Lincoln Mitchell. Lincoln Mitchell, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me, Ron.
So this is a very thought-provoking book, Will Big League Baseball Survive? How do you define survival?
Well, I address that in the book. Really, I define survival as surviving in its current form. And what I mean by that is this very lucrative, very big industry, which essentially draws the best baseball players from all over the world to 29 teams in the United States and one in Canada. And importantly, that wasn't always what Big League Baseball was. Big League Baseball really only evolved with that in the last decade or two. And this question of can it sustain that is addressed throughout the book.
Now, is when you say big league, do you equate that with major league? Because, you know, when you say something is big league,
yeah,
it's professional.
Right, and we've certainly heard that term used oddly in recent months by our president-elect. Mm-hmm. I actually make the difference here. I mean, the title, Will Big League Baseball Survive, just sounds better. So we kind of went with that. But the subtitle is explicit. It's talking about the future of Major League Baseball. Because big league, you know, does for colloquially, well, now you're in the big leagues now, you know, now you have a good job or something. But Major League Baseball is a brand name, and
right,
it is an industry, and it is a company. And so, and I talk about that as well, how these terms are not 100% interchangeable, but are largely interchangeable.
Now, I'm of a certain age. I'm not sure how old you are, but when I was a kid, you go down to the park, your local park, and you find other kids to play with. It wasn't organized. Now everything is organized, and I think part of the problem of survival is that this is meeting with a lot of other options that we didn't have when we were kids. We didn't have computers when we were kids. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have video games. All that is taking away from the idyllic American thought of young boys and girls playing baseball. And how do you address that in the book?
I'm also of the same, more or less, I would assume the same age, because I too grew up playing in the sandlot. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. I grew up playing in the sandlots of San Francisco, and a friend of mine, who I've known since third grade, which was, you know, 150 years ago, worked for several years on a tour bus in San Francisco. And the bus would go by the sandlot, and he's not a big baseball guy, but they would go by the sandlot where I had played as a boy, you know, the playground, the park. And among the other people who learned to play baseball in that park was Joe DiMaggio. And my friend would say, this is where Joe DiMaggio and Lincoln Mitchell learned to play baseball. But youth sports in general and youth baseball has changed a lot. And the biggest change is the specialization. And I really want to talk about this in somewhat of a value-neutral role way, because there is a point after about 13 or 14 when the specialization is very helpful. But before then, it isn't. But what that means is two things. One, that the best soccer players are playing soccer, the best basketball, the best baseball. So the middle of the youth sports bell curve is never there. You watch 12-year-olds playing Little League, if you get to a rec league game, if they exist anymore even, and the top three or four players are really better than the 12-year-olds when I was growing up, and everyone else is terrible, right? And the other thing is that there are, forgetting just the kind of you know, when I was a kid, there was three stations in PBS. So television was actually kind of boring unless baseball was on, you know, during the daytime. There were no computers. There was none of that. There were books, and that was a lot of how we learned about baseball, the same way kids today learn about baseball by watching, you know, the highlights on MLB Advanced Media and various other apps. But also, other activities are also more structured. So I talk about this in the book, that I had two twin brother friends growing up. One of them played, you know, baseball and basketball. The other skateboarded and surfed. And people viewed him as kind of weird and dangerous and not athletic, even though he was, in fact, I mean, try surfing at Ocean Beach in California. It's very difficult. He was very athletic. Today, there would be structures. You know, you can join the surf club, the surf team, the skateboard club. It'll be that parental involvement. Now, some of that is good. I'm not really coming down. I'm not a psychologist, a child specialist. But it does, what it means is that fewer people grow up really playing and understanding and liking any game. And that raises a challenge for sustaining fans, you know, over the coming years and decades.
So much of what you write makes me think of the youth of America and around the world, I guess, you know, following baseball. You mentioned Joe DiMaggio a little while ago. One of the things that I particularly enjoyed in your book is your reference to the wealth of books on baseball.
Yes.
More so than any other sport pretty much combined. 70 years ago or more, before the television was readily available in homes, people would learn about baseball through sports writers. You don't have that anymore because everybody pretty much has access to every single game if they're willing to shell out the money for the watching it via MLB. It's kind of reduced the role of the journalist. And many years ago, people were saying that sports journalism was what kept the newspapers going, was that everybody was interested in sports. So I'm wondering if you think that what's happened now with the way we experience baseball has contributed to the downfall of print journalism.
I think in some extent it has. I mean, the media has changed so much, right? I mean, I am struck. I am of the generation where, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area. I was of the Bay Area teams, I was a strong Giants fan. I never really got into the A's. Giants were on television 15, 20 games a year when I was a kid, right? There was one game on television, and what that meant was it wasn't that we were deprived or that we had it better. It was just the way it was. But what that meant is that if we wanted information, we had to read the newspapers, my brother and I, every day, and read the box scores every day and read the local guys analyzing. You know, we were also Yankee fans, so, you know, what are the Yankees going to do? How's that pennant race shaping up? Now, on the West Coast, it's always better because the times, at least you get all the scores, right? What I noticed, I have two sons who are baseball guys, and for them, they're also Giants fans, although we live in New York now. But for them, what they want to do is watch the highlight on the iPad. And you know what? That is kind of cool, right? I mean, I was going to say if Johnny LeMaster made a great play at shortstop, but that's a very hypothetical situation. So let me move away from that. Let me say if, you know, Larry Herndon made a running catch in center field for the Giants, I'd have to read about it or hear, you know, Lindsey Nelson or someone describe it on the radio. Seeing it is very cool, right? But it does two things. One is it contributes, I agree, to the downfall of print journalism. And really where we see this is in the political front, right? I mean, in my view, you know, the absence of resources going to investigative journalism has tremendous impacts on political outcomes, right? So that's one thing we see. But it also has an impact on breaking down the barrier between the insider and the outsider in sports and in other endeavors, right? It used to be that if you had a press pass to a game, you had some access that no one else had. And you could use or misuse that. You could say, you know, gee, you don't really know what you're talking about. You're just looking at numbers. But I saw that play, right? Today, everybody can see that play, and everybody can see it on StatCast and can slow it down and see the replay. So to some sense, it's an equalizer. The sports writer who really wants to be persuasive has to have access to really very special information or has to be just very smart. Meanwhile, people on the outside can write very effectively about baseball. So on the one hand, while there's this downfall of kind of some aspects of traditional journalism, there's so much more available, right? If you want to know, if you're a Pittsburgh Pirates fan and you want to know about the Pirates farm system, it's so much easier now. There's so many good people writing about that, you know, for virtually every aspect of the game. So it really has changed. You can go deeper, but I think fewer people are going into it.
Now that leads me into my next question. You write about ego casting. What is ego casting?
Well, ego casting, so broadcasting, you know, let's take it back a few steps. Broadcasting is we all sit down, we watch Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw, right? And then we go to school or we go to work, and we talk about what we saw. So if we took the 2016 election, and we, you know, in a broadcasting framework, we would all see Walter Cronkite, Tom Brokaw, and we would say, well, I think Hillary Clinton's emails are a serious thing. And I'd say, oh, I don't think it's that big of a deal. But we'd be talking about the same things, right? Narrowcasting is a conservative might be reading Breitbart online and watching Fox News. A liberal might be reading the Huffington Post and watching MSNBC, except for that Morning Joe show, right? And then when we came together, we wouldn't really be talking about the same things because the Huffington Post isn't talking about emails, right? They're talking about, they're talking about police brutality. And the conservative media is talking about emails. So there's really even less of a common ground. Ego casting is that I am, to put it in a baseball context, I'm a Giants fan that's really interested in the Giants minor league system. You're a Cincinnati Reds fan that's interested in the history of the Reds. Maybe you're obsessed with the big red machine from the 70s, right? So and then you talk about that with regards to the way you're getting political information, musical information, whatever it is your hobbies are or your interests are, so that people really, there's no common ground at all. And why that's relevant for baseball is that, you know, more and more people, I mean, I had somebody who read the book and, you know, was telling me their feedback, and they said, you know, this person was a Giants fan, and he said, you know, I stopped watching when the Giants were eliminated. This was an older guy. He's in his 70s probably, at least, maybe 60s or 70s. And, you know, 30 years ago, he would have just watched the postseason all the way through. Mm-hmm. But narrowcasting means, or ego casting means that once our story ends, we go to the next thing that involves us, which may not be the Chicago Cubs and the Cleveland Indians in this case.
And going back to kids for a minute, and television, and everything seems to be intertwined. One of the big complaints, especially in the postseason, is that the powers that be decide to start these games so late that it basically rules out younger fans being able to watch to the completion of the game. I mean, look at what happened in Game 7 of this year's World Series. Not only did it go into extra innings, but there was a rain delay.
Yeah.
What are they going to do to try to get the next generation of kids interested in baseball? If they keep on doing this...
I will just say anecdotally that imagine having two teenage sons who were huge San Francisco Giants fans and having box seats to that Giants-Mets game and telling them they couldn't go because they had school the next day. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in the Mitchell household, so that was not a lot of fun. The game was a great game. It was my friend, but they were not happy about that.
Yep.
This is a real problem, and in the book I propose a very simple and very important solution, and I don't know that it's going to happen, but it's a very real one, which is reach out to girls. Baseball is the only sport where girls play a really different game. I guess football they don't really play at all. But basketball, you watch a 13, 14, 15, 17-year-old girl playing basketball, and she's playing the exact same game as the boys are, right? Lacrosse, soccer, obviously various track and field events. Baseball it isn't. And I'm not making a judgment about softball. I enjoy watching women's softball on television if it's, you know, on ESPN or a college softball game or something like that. But that's not the same as baseball. And those girls who don't get to play baseball lose interest in it. Now, according to most data, girls are roughly half the children in the world and half the children in the United States. So when you turn them off, but there's something more nefarious than that going on, right? And I cite a scholar from University of Nevada at Reno, Jennifer Ring, who discusses this. The irony, of course, and we see this, I've seen this in my own experience with youth baseball, is the girls who are good as they get to be about 11 or 12, they're on the end of the most ugly sexism, right? The girls who aren't good lose interest. The girls who are good, who make a travel team, right? What they then hear is, you're taking up a spot that could go to a boy who could get a scholarship. Well, if you're better, shouldn't you get that spot regardless of if you're a boy or a girl, right? And if you can't get the 12th spot on a travel team, you're not getting a scholarship to play anywhere anyway, right? But the point is, by excluding girls, that young girl then grows up and says, I had a bad experience with baseball. It left a bad feeling in me. I don't want to become a fan. And, you know, it's hard enough. Baseball has a problem with the younger demographic anyway. To write off half of that younger demographic is foolish. So this is an easily solvable problem if you invest in bringing girls into baseball.
When you go to the ballpark these days, there seems to be an experience. It's an experience. It's not just you go
right
to watch a game. You sit, you go with your pals, you have a beer or two, and you discuss what's going on at a leisurely pace. Now it's constant bombardment of music. There are specialty restaurants. There are gift shops all over the place. We went to a game recently, first time I was ever in a luxury box. And the luxury boxes are not for people who really want to watch the game because you have a few rows of seats in front,
And everything else is like your living room. You've got a TV, you've got couches, you've got snacks.
I had a funny experience at Luxury Box recently, about a couple of years ago, maybe it was about 4 years ago now. It was at Yankee Stadium, and I was with a school group with my older son. And, of course, the kids are drinking soda, eating hot dogs and stuff. And I said, yeah, I'd like a beer. And they said, we can't sell you beer. We can sell you a bottle of vodka. And I said, you know, I'm here with 20 kids. They're eighth graders. What am I going to do? I don't want a bottle of vodka for $100. I want a beer. And I ended up having a water. I think we have to be careful here. And you've read the book, so you know this. People who haven't read the book may not have known this. The tone of this book is not kvetchy, to use a technical term. This is very much reflects my ongoing love for baseball. And I think when you read that, you see that. And I want to be careful about coming off as an old man if baseball's not what it was in the 70s, right, or the 50s or the 60s. I love baseball. I think if you can't appreciate baseball today, you can't appreciate baseball at all. If you can't love watching Kyle Hendricks, you know, in Game 7 of the World Series, if you can't love watching Bruce Bochy or Terry Francona or Joe Maddon in the chess match of the postseason, a great shortstop like Brandon Crawford or Andrelton Simmons, if you don't think guys like Mike Trout are just spectacular baseball players, you don't really understand the game. So I love the baseball today, but it is changing. And the stadium experience is changing, but it's changing as part of the cycle that is driven by the economics of baseball, right? If the top players are getting $25 million a year, that means they have to sell tickets for more money, which means they have to provide a better product for the fans, right? And the better product is, includes better food, the noise thing, I think we're just old and the culture has changed. But, you know, I mean, I don't know how much I miss, cold hot chocolate, rubber hot dogs, and kind of French fries with the cheapest possible ketchup on it, right, which is what I ate at ballpark growing up in San Francisco, right? So, and I don't know any Giants fan, and I know many, many Giants fans who's ever said to me, you know, I wish they hadn't built AT&T Park and the Giants were still playing at Candlestick. Many Giants fans will say, I miss Candlestick, but everyone recognizes the improvement. So the product that is on the field, I think, is very strong. The question of whether it can be sustained is a different one, and that's the one I address in the book. And one of the scenarios, you know, I don't make policy prescriptions because my background is, as an academic, is in political science and foreign policy. And foreign policy prescriptions tend to begin with things like, first, Russia should get out of Crimea, right? But if that's your recommendation, that's not a serious thing, right? That's the answer. But I lay out scenarios. And one of them is kind of something you're touching on, which is that as the financial problems, which I talk about in the book, what those could look like, grow, baseball may simply get smaller. It may go back to being a little bit what it was like 20, 30 years ago. The hot dogs probably won't be that bad, but they may not feel them. They may not have a market for luxury boxes, that many. So they may make the game smaller, lower ticket prices, offer fewer of the frills. And I think for true baseball fans, that would be fine.
Now, you mentioned your background in political science. You have a very interesting podcast. I'd like you to tell us about that.
Well, my podcast is called Painting the Corners, the Baseball International Affairs Podcast. And what I do in the podcast is I try to bring into conversation somebody from the world of foreign policy and somebody from the world of baseball. So, for example, the one I just posted today has the foreign policy guest is a guy named Irakli Alasania, who was the defense minister in Georgia for several years and was the Georgian ambassador to the United Nations and is a major Georgian political figure. He recently lost an election, but he's a young guy. He's not done in Georgian politics. And then the baseball guest was Joe Sheehan, who I'm sure many people have read his work, and if not, you know, they should. He's a really wonderful baseball writer. And I bring them into conversation, and we talk kind of half about baseball, half about foreign policy. And what happens is that many of the guests going in, the baseball person will say, I'm a baseball writer, or I'm a baseball coach, or I'm a baseball player. I don't know about foreign policy. And the foreign policy person comes in, especially if they're not American, and they say, I don't really know anything about baseball. But we really do have interesting conversations, primarily because they each ask questions that I wouldn't ask, right? So a foreign person who may not know a lot about baseball may ask a question about baseball that I wouldn't have considered, right? And I have one guy, a former diplomat, said, how do you teach a five-year-old when they walk in and want to learn to play baseball? What's the first thing you say to them? Well, I've never thought about that question, right? And, you know, a lot of baseball people are very smart, and they have a lot of thoughts about foreign policy, but want an opportunity to talk about it. So that's what I try to do in the podcast. And, you know, it certainly is an outgrowth of the book, where the book draws on my passion for baseball, but also my decades working in foreign policy.
And how do people find your podcast?
How do people find it? You can go to my website, lincolnmitchell.com, and it's just on the left. It says Podcast Painting the Corners. And you can also find it on iTunes and Stitcher, and you can rate and review it there.
And we've been talking with Lincoln Mitchell, author of Will Big League Baseball Survive? Globalization, the End of Television, Youth Sports, and the Future of Major League Baseball. Lincoln, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Lincoln Mitchell. Be sure to check the blog regularly for news of our next exciting guest in the world of baseball pop culture. It could be a writer, a musician, a filmmaker. You never know. I never know until the last minute. So visit Ron Kaplan's BaseballBookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on the game we all love. And remember, if you ever have a question or a comment or a suggestion, please email me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.
I've seen Matty pitching that fader so grand. He'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.